You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last month, Michelle Rhee was the subject of a segment on the show that focused on a frontline documentary called The Education of Michelle Rhee. It was a look at her controversial tenure as chancellor of the Washington, D.C. public school system. And now, Ms. Rhee is here today in person to talk about her controversial efforts to overhaul what was the nation's worst performing public school system and her current efforts to take those reforms national through a political advocacy organization she's founded called Students First. She discusses both in her new book called Radical. It's from HarperCollins. I'm very pleased that it brings Michelle Rhee to our show. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You have been called one of the most admired and reviled school reformers in America. Do you get more fan mail or hate mail these days?
Well, I get lots of fan mail. I'd say the hate mail probably doesn't come directly to me. It mostly lives on the blogosphere.
One of the controversial things that you did during the 3 years that you were the D.C. school's chancellor, which resulted in a scandal, was to give teachers raises and cash bonuses if their students improved their scores in standardized tests. Wasn't it later discovered that a suspiciously large number of answers have been erased and changed from wrong to right at some of the schools with the most dramatic improvements?
Yeah, so that was the question at hand, and we actually had investigators come in to look at it. There were, over a course of a number of years, five separate investigations that happened, including the Office of the Inspector General of D.C. and the U.S. Department of Education. All of them looked at this and found that there was no evidence of widespread cheating, but that there were issues at one particular school.
You were criticized for how you reacted to the allegations. And in your book, you've called your reaction misguided. What did you do wrong?
Yeah, you know, initially when people were questioning the results, it frustrated me because I knew how hard the children and teachers in our system had worked. And I knew that the results that they had seen were real. And that's why I think I had an initial negative reaction. But shortly after that, I realized, you know what, if people have questions about what we did, we have to be very open to an investigation because test security is very important.
Well, did you feel that the critics were questioning not only your methods, but also the idea that these poor minority students in D.C. had the ability to improve their academic performance?
That was definitely part of my frustration. Part of what plagues us in American education today is the fact that I think many people have very low expectations of poor minority kids and really question whether or not they can rise up from the situations of poverty that they face every day to achieve in schools. And we know now that that is absolutely possible. But it was also frustrating to me to hear critics say, you created an environment where the teachers wanted to cheat. And I know so many teachers. I come from teachers. I talk to teachers every day. And I know for a fact the vast majority of teachers in this country would never do that.
But there is still a great deal of disagreement about how teachers should be evaluated, especially in the light of the challenges they face, the poverty you just mentioned. Some come from difficult home situations. They suffer from learning disabilities or they have difficulty with the language. How do you answer objections to rating teacher performance based mainly on scores from standardized tests? And one of the reasons I ask you is I'm uncomfortable admitting this now, but I graduated from high school with a C average. I did poorly on tests, and I've always wondered how much are tests predictors of future success?
Well, the first thing to know about how we should evaluate teachers is that while student achievement growth should be one major part of that, it should not be the only factor that we look at. So we should also look at observations of classroom practice and the more recent trend these days that has been shown to correlate very highly with teacher effectiveness is how the students themselves are rating the teachers and the parents that have kids in that classroom. So in any teacher evaluation system that we have to look through multiple measures to get a holistic sense of how that teacher is doing. I think the most important thing, and this would pertain to students like you who don't do particularly well on tests, is to make sure that we don't just look at the absolutes of, is this child on grade level or not? Because kids start off the year at very varying degrees of skills. And so what we advocate for is what is called a value-added growth model, which means you measure the kid at the beginning of the year, you measure the kid at the end of the year, and you see how much growth has been attained.
But we are ultimately testing them, their knowledge, in a uniform way, no matter how different all these kids are.
But when you're taking into account the growth measures, then you can actually take kids at different levels. That's one thing. And then the second thing is for certain kids like special needs children, for an example, there are increasingly alternative tests that are given to those kids or accommodations that are given to those kids to take into account their particular situations.
Doesn't the reliance on test results force teachers to teach the test, which many have complained about? Are students learning the material, or are they just learning to do better on a standardized test?
That is a great question. And in fact, I think that one of the downsides that can come is sort of an overemphasis on the test and the potential teaching to the test. But here's how I think we can avoid it. The research is very clear that teachers who teach to the test, their children actually do not do as well academically as teachers who teach a broader curriculum and who are focused on analytical and critical thinking skills. And I think a lot of people don't know that. The more that we can educate our teachers and our principals about this fact and the fact that teaching the test actually doesn't result in better test scores, I think we're going to see a broadening of the kinds of teaching strategies that we're seeing.
How much of your thinking comes out of your own experience teaching second grade with Teach for America in inner city Baltimore after you left college?
Well, that experience changed my life and shaped my entire professional career because I was a teacher in a school with a group of kids that people would have said, well, they can't possibly learn at the highest levels because they face such significant challenges coming in every day. I taught in one of the lowest performing schools in the entire city. And yet what I found was that when you set high expectations for kids, when you worked really hard, when you engaged their parents, and you were very rigorous about what you were doing, that those kids rose to the expectations.
But I do remember seeing a documentary about one of those schools in Baltimore where a lot of the kids just roamed the hallways. They couldn't get them to attend classes. When there were parent-teacher nights, the parents who showed up were generally the parents of the kids who did well. Mm-hmm. The other kids' parents didn't seem to care. They didn't encourage them to do their homework.
Yeah. You know, it was interesting. My first year as a teacher, I had four parents show up for parent-teacher conferences. And I thought, well, gosh, what's wrong? Are the parents not engaged? Do they not care? And what I found out over time when I really started to reach out to parents was that a number of them had two jobs, for example. They couldn't actually come in. They had, you know, a number of responsibilities, other small kids at home, et cetera. And that what my responsibility as a teacher was to open the lines of communication so that we weren't just relying on one parent-teacher conference night, but that I was constantly reaching out to them. And I found that when I did that and I moved my schedule around to accommodate them, that they were more than willing to engage with me.
But when teachers say we need more parent involvement, you kind of object to that.
No, absolutely not. I think that that the research is very clear that that when we have environments where parents are more involved, the kids in the schools do better. So we should absolutely do everything that we can to encourage more parental involvement.
Do education classes prepare teachers well for teaching? Because so many say, you know, I learned all this stuff and then I came to a classroom and pretty much my job was getting the kids to be quiet.
I think that it varies tremendously. I think there are some schools of education now that are really innovating and trying to prepare teachers more for the rigors of the real classroom. I think, though, that far too many of our schools of education are teaching teachers in the way that teachers were taught 30 years ago, and they really aren't preparing them for the rigors of the accountability that exists today.
Wasn't your time in Baltimore around the same time that you killed a bee and ate it?
Yes, that's one of the stories that I told in my book, Radical, which is that I was having trouble controlling the class. And because of that, a bee had flown into the classroom and the kids were screaming and running around and saying, a bee, a bee, a bee. And they were paying more attention to the insect than they were me. So when the bee landed on the radiator, I rolled up my lesson plan and I smacked it and I didn't really know what to do with it. So I flicked it in my hand and I swallowed it and the kids were like, ah. And after that, they behaved a little better because they thought, well, maybe this lady's a little nuts.
You've said that you're still in contact with some of those students.
I am. A number of them, found me via social media and, you know, tweet me and email me. And it's actually rewarding to hear from them.
My guest is Michelle Rhee. Her book, Radical, Fighting to put students first. After you left Teach for America, you started a company to recruit effective teachers for public school systems that needed help to fill openings. Wasn't it during that time that you began working with New York City school chancellor Joel Klein? You've called him your mentor.
Yeah, he has been a real hero to me. He was one of the best superintendents that we worked with at the New Teacher Project, in that he was always engaged, always looking for ways to better the system and make sure that we were bringing great teachers in to the city. And then he was actually the one who recommended me for the job in D.C. So I think he always felt a little guilty about that and kind of took me under his wing and made sure that he was supporting me in any way possible.
Hey, did you play a role in his negotiations with the teachers union, which were headed by and still are headed by Randy Weingarten?
In 2005, yeah, I was asked to come and testify at the independent arbitration hearing because the union and the UFT and the school district were at odds and they were at impasse on the contract. And so we brought some of the data from a study that we had done on New York City that showed that a lot of the practices that were memorialized in the union collective bargaining agreement were actually hurting kids and were not good for schools.
The most contentious issues concerned policies that forced principals to hire teachers who'd been deemed incompetent after they'd been let go from other schools, and around what was known as the rubber room.
Yeah. Well, teachers and parents across the city see this every day. They see somebody who might be an ineffective teacher who's sort of bounced around from school to school to school. And it frustrates a lot of people because they say, look, if we know that this person is not effective, then we either need to invest in their professional development and get them to become better very quickly, or we need to remove them from the system. But we can't continue to subject children to an ineffective teacher year in and year out.
And the rubber room, they just simply sat there and got paid because nobody wanted them?
It was actually a pretty crazy dynamic, because what the chancellor got in that negotiation was the right to not have to force ineffective teachers into the classroom, but he also wasn't able to fire them. And so he had to keep them on the payroll, and they were housed in what were affectionately known as these rubber rooms. And it was literally costing the school district millions of dollars a year to house these folks who weren't teaching every day.
Well, it wasn't that way when I went to school, although there was already a teachers union.
You know, I think over the years we have memorialized into collective bargaining agreements more and more policies that actually aren't good for kids. I think it's very much common sense that you would have a teacher evaluation system, that if you have high-performing teachers, you recognize and reward them. If you have ineffective ones, you have a mechanism through which you can swiftly move them out of the system.
Didn't Joel Klein later recommend you for the chancellor job in Washington?
He did. When the mayor and the city council there were considering taking on mayoral control of the schools, they came up here to visit Bloomberg and Klein, and the Mayor Fenty said, well, I want somebody like you to become chancellor, so, you know, do you have any recommendations? And a couple days later, Joel Klein called him back and said, yeah, you should hire Michelle Rhee.
Well, after you left Washington, were you tempted to follow Joel Klein into Rupert Murdoch's inner circle?
You know what? I actually made the decision to leave D.C. before Joel Klein left, but I knew that I had to stay in this realm of public education and get into this political advocacy, and that's why I started Students First.
Michelle Rhee's book is called Radical, Fighting to Put Students First. It's published by Harper. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Michelle Rhee, who has written a book called Radical, Fighting to Put Students First, about her experience as chancellor of the Washington, D.C. school system, and then later as the founder of a group called Students First. The book is published by Harper, and listeners have been writing in. Patrick wonders on Twitter, are there any recent examples of new ideas that have made you change your outlook about education?
Well, I'd say one of the things that I've seen recently is the use of what we call blended learning or technology in the classroom. And there are a few examples of schools that are using it out in California, and the early results look very, very promising.
We mentioned that you were hired by Adrian Fenty after he was elected mayor in 2006. You've said that he failed to impress you at your first meeting, that you hesitated to take the job because it looked to you like the worst job in the world. The D.C. school district had gone through six superintendents in the 10 years before you.
You know, I was in public education reform, and I thought, gosh, being an urban superintendent is the worst job I can imagine. I mean, you know, you have all this responsibility, yet you have very little power to change anything. People are always yelling and screaming at you. And so that's kind of why I thought, well, I don't think that's ever a job that I wanted to do. And while Adrian Fenty didn't impress me during that first meeting, the more I got to know him, the more I realized this guy was really willing to put politics aside and do what was right for kids.
And you've said his style could be distilled into three elements: speed, no excuses, and accountability. Could that describe your style as well?
We matched together very well in that we were singularly focused on fixing a broken system and doing so with the North Star of always doing what was right for kids.
When you took over, how did the Washington, D.C. school system stack up against schools in other large cities?
When we took over the school system in 2007, it was largely known as the most dysfunctional and the lowest performing school district in the entire nation. We were on high risk status with the U.S. Department of Education, and only 8% of the eighth graders in the city schools were operating on grade level in mathematics.
And you point out that poor student performance in reading and math in Washington couldn't just be blamed on students coming from poor economic circumstances, because similar kids in New York, Houston, and Boston were doing much better.
That's right. An example that I always used for the people in D.C. was that the children in New York City, the poor black children in New York City, were operating two full grade levels of the poor black African-American kids in Washington, D.C., and they were living in, you know, very similar environments in terms of poverty and challenges.
So what do you think the problem was? It couldn't be the unions. There are unions here as well.
You know, it was interesting because people said, well, you know, what's the problem? Let's just, you know, figure out what the one problem is and then solve it. And the reality was that there was no one thing that had driven the D.C. school system to become as bad as it was. And there was no one silver bullet solution that we were going to be able to put in place that was going to fix it. It was going to take time.
Now, there are non-union school systems around the country. Do they do any better?
You know, it's interesting because many of the laws and policies that are in place that really stop unionized cities and states from being able to kind of implement the programs and the initiatives that they see fit are also the same laws and policies that are in place in some of the southern right-to-work states as well. So it's not really – a lot of people want to blame the union and say the union is the sole problem. In my mind, that's not the case, because the teachers' union's purpose is to advocate for the privileges, pays, and pay and priority of their members, and they do an excellent job of that. We can't begrudge them for what they're doing.
And they try to protect seniority rights. They try to protect tenure rights.
Right. But and this is where we think
academic
that
academic freedom.
We think that this is where some of the problems exist, because, for example, in protecting seniority, what states like New York and other states across the country have done is said, well, we're going to say in state law that when layoffs occur, for example, they must be done by seniority, which means if you are the last teacher hired, you must be the first teacher fired, regardless of performance. That makes absolutely no sense to either educators, to parents out there. I can't tell you how many parents that I've talked to who have been so frustrated because their kid has a great teacher, happens to be a newer teacher, and they're the one that's laid off. It is extraordinarily frustrating for parents like that to go through circumstances that I've described.
On the other hand, experience is a really generally important when you're a teacher, somebody who's been teaching for a while. And also, there's just the whole matter of many places where they fire the older workers to save money on pensions and the like. And unions are out there trying to protect the older workers.
There should absolutely be unions to protect the interests of their members. But the reality is that while there are absolutely some outstanding veteran teachers out there who have dedicated their careers to doing right by kids, we should not make decisions that are going to impact children solely based on seniority when we also know that there are very effective novice teachers out there.
So your tenure as D.C. school chancellor was controversial, not just because of the alleged cheating scandal we mentioned earlier, but because you closed school, fired principals and teachers who weren't performing up to your expectations.
When I inherited the school district, as I said earlier, only 8% of the eighth graders were on grade level in mathematics. But when I looked at the performance evaluations of the adults in the system at the same time, I found that 98% of them were being rated as doing an excellent job. And you just cannot run a functional organization when you have that kind of a disconnect between what people are supposed to be doing and the results that we were producing for kids.
What were the teachers telling you was the reason?
You know, it actually was not the teachers' fault. The teachers were not the ones that came up with the evaluation system. It was a bureaucracy that was just stymied by these antiquated laws and policies and rules and regulations.
What about the school closings? How many schools did you close, and how did you decide which ones should be shuttered?
Over the course of the time that I was there, we closed approximately 30 schools, which in a school district of only 144 schools when I got there, it was a pretty significant number. We decided which schools to close based on a very comprehensive formula that included student achievement rates, that included attendance levels, that included growth in the community, and that sort of thing.
And you also ended up firing a number of administrators after you discovered a warehouse full of books and materials that had never been distributed to the students?
Yeah.
What were they doing with it?
It was
an incredibly
frustrating situation because I was out in the schools. I was talking to principals and teachers who were saying, we don't have, you know, the basic supplies, crayons, paper, books. And then I went into this warehouse that the school district had, and I was opening box after box, and I was finding computers and rulers and all the things that the teachers were having to spend money out of their own pockets to buy. And it was just amazing to me that you could have a bureaucracy where you were actually purchasing things and they were sitting in a warehouse somewhere instead of getting to where the kids were and where they needed them. And it was just one of the most eye-opening experiences.
And for what reason? Why weren't they being distributed?
You know, I think at the end of the day, it was a lack of accountability. I mean, this warehouse had just built up with all these boxes where nobody was being held accountable for. When things come in, it is your responsibility to make sure that they get out to the schools.
You were called insensitive for firing a principal on camera, a footage of which was included in that Frontline documentary, even though the principal's identity is disguised. When you look back, do you think it was a mistake to be filmed firing somebody?
You know, people have asked me that a lot, and what I know is that it was not a mistake to fire that principal. He was ineffective, and he was not doing good things for kids. But sometimes the how of what you do is just as important as the what. And so should I have fired that principal? Absolutely. Should I have done it on national TV? No.
Ainsley asks on Twitter, a listener, what did you think about the education of Michelle Rhee?
I actually am a little embarrassed to say that I have not watched it yet because the last couple of weeks for me have been so busy. But I've heard from lots of people who've watched it and a lot of people who didn't necessarily know me. And their takeaway was, after watching that, I really got a sense for how hard your job was.
My sense was that it tried to be as balanced as possible.
I think that was probably the case, given the fact that I was hearing from people, oh, it wasn't fair, and then I was hearing from other people, oh, it was a whitewash. So when you get those kinds of differing opinions, you probably were pretty balanced.
My guest is Michelle Rhee. Her book, Radical, Fighting to Put Students First, is published by Harper. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You seem to have what's often described as a thick skin. Is your ability to withstand criticism something that you were born with? Your mother said that she noticed it when you were young.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting because when I was in the height of the D.C. era, I came home one day during a particularly tough time where I was being protested, et cetera, and my mom was there, and she said, are you doing okay? And I said, yeah, I'm doing fine. And she said, you know, when you were little, you never seemed to care what people thought about you. She said, I always thought that you were going to grow up to be antisocial. She said, but I see now that it is serving you well. And I said, yeah, it really is. I think when people care too much about being liked, that sometimes it causes you to avoid really difficult decisions, and we couldn't afford to do that anymore in D.C.
Well, in the documentary, we watch you maintain an impassive expression on your faces at a meeting about potential school closings where people are screaming at you. Did you feel as unruffled as you appear?
You know, people have often asked me, like, what was going through your head when you were getting screamed and yelled at and people are throwing things at you? And I said, over and over again, what I kept thinking in my mind is, you can yell at me all you want, but I am not going to continue to allow this school district to do a disservice to children, not on my watch.
In an interview with you that was in last Sunday's New York Times magazine, Andrew Goldman told you he assumed that you love publicity because you've attracted so much of it, and you told him you'd been naive about the press.
Yeah, I think that when I went to D.C., I really thought that my job was just to run the school system, and I didn't think at all about kind of communications or PR strategy or anything like that. And so when people would call and say, you know, do you want to do this interview? Do you want to? I'd say, okay. We didn't have a particularly sophisticated strategy when it came to that. So when I started this, I was definitely very naive.
And you probably would have refused the Time magazine photographer's request that you post for a cover photo holding a broom.
Again, very naivete at its best. I mean, you know, back then I didn't understand all the ramifications that these various things were going to have.
Don't you have children in school?
I do. I have a 14-year-old and a 10-year-old.
I'm sure their teachers are thrilled when you show up. But how do you approach the teachers and the principals and the district as a parent?
You know, I tried to run the school district as a parent, knowing that every single decision that I made was going to affect my own two kids. And, you know, my kids took a lot of heat for it. When I didn't cancel school, for example, my kids would come home and say, all the kids yelled at me because you didn't cancel school today.
Because it snowed?
Because it snowed, yes, and that sort of thing. But, you know, my kids have been very fortunate. They've had very effective teachers for the most part, and I try to be a pretty low-maintenance mom.
Adrian Fenty failed to win re-election. You lost your job as chancellor in 2010. How long would you ideally have wanted to stay in the job?
The mayor and I had originally always said that we thought it was going to take 2 terms or 8 years to really turn the system around. And so when he lost that re-election bid, I was devastated, and because I really thought that we could do so much more if we were going to be there for 4 more years.
And in the days that followed that election, you received calls from governors and other officials in New Jersey, Nevada, New Mexico, Tennessee, Ohio, Maine. Were they all offering you a job?
Well, they were asking me to help their school systems in their various states.
And come in as an advisor consultant.
In various capacities. And while I wanted to do that, what I also knew was that the school reform movement had to become much more politically active and engaged, because the reason why in many ways we lost the mayor's election was because we didn't have any political muscle.
So you decided instead to start Students First,
yes,
which is a political advocacy group.
Yeah, we're a membership organization. We have 2 million members across the entire country. We have more than 150,000 members in New York State. And what our organization is a grassroots organization that's just fighting for very common sense reforms.
And what do you want your members to do?
We really push our members to put a lot of pressure on their political officials and public officials in their regions and in their districts to make the right decisions for kids. And so, for example, when we introduce a piece of legislation in a state, we'll let all of our members know and then say, okay, you know, contact your elected official and let them know that you're going to hold them accountable for voting for this law.
Same sort of thing the NRA does.
I suppose in many ways.
I'm not going to ask your position on guns in schools.
I will tell you that we looked at a lot of advocacy organizations when we were forming Students First, and what we wanted to do was make sure that we had a very active membership that was very singularly focused on our issue of education.
And you launched Students First on the Oprah Winfrey Show on December 6, 2010. You'd
yeah.
been on her show just a couple of months earlier.
Yeah. That was a thrill for me, and she is such a champion for public education and for making sure that kids get what they need, that when I said I was going to start this effort, she said, okay, I'm going to help you launch it. We said that we wanted to have 1 million members by the end of our first year, and she said to everyone, she said, okay, we've got 10 million viewers. Everybody's got to log on right now and join, and it was a huge boon to us.
Now, you were able to mobilize your members in Florida a month later when Rick Scott, Florida's newly elected governor, asked you to help him reform Florida's public education system. Now, Rick Scott is one of the most unpopular governors in the United States right now, partly because he is one step away from being to the right of the Tea Party. And many of the governors who approached you or other officials were also very conservative. People see you as a conservative figure. Do you see yourself as politically conservative?
Absolutely not. I'm probably as liberal a Democrat as you can get. And it's interesting the fact that when people try to figure out our political positions, they always tend to point out the conservative Republicans that that support us, but they leave out people like Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa from L.A., people like Cory Booker, my husband, who is the mayor of Sacramento, California. These are very, very prominent people in the Democratic Party who have taken a very strong stand on education reform. And I think what people are missing is the fact that this is a bipartisan issue, and it has to be a bipartisan issue if we're going to fix the schools.
So what's happened to the school system in Washington? Is it still the lowest performing in the nation?
It has gotten a lot better. In fact, in just after our first 2 years in office, we moved from being the lowest performing school district in the country to leading the nation in gains in both reading and math and at both the fourth and eighth grade level. And that progress has continued since then.
And in your book, you cite two success stories published in the New York Times about individual teachers who chose to stay in the D.C. system because of the changes that you'd implemented.
Yeah, one of the things that we wanted to make sure is that we were recognizing and rewarding the highly effective teachers who were really doing heroic things for kids every day. And though teachers don't come into the profession for money, recognizing and valuing them for their work is important. So we put in place a new teacher evaluation system, and with that, a new pay-for-performance plan that allowed teachers who were teaching in the lowest performing schools in high-need subject areas, if they were highly effective, they could make almost twice as much money as they were in the old system.
You divide your time between Sacramento, where your husband is the mayor,
yes,
and Nashville, Tennessee.
Yes.
Where do your kids go to school?
My kids go to school in Nashville. Their father
are there better
is
schools
the
in Nashville than Sacramento?
Well, their father is the commissioner of education there, so we had to plant the kids firmly in one city.
Michelle Rhee's book, Radical: Fighting to Put Students First, is published by Harper. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.